Well, I'd like to welcome people to the next in our series of Global Health Perspective podcasts. My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And we've been having a range of podcasts, particularly during this period of the pandemic, that really address issues on the edge of science, health, and in some cases, obviously, related to smoking. Today, it's my real pleasure to have Corrie Latham join. I've known Corrie for a number of years as an extraordinary cutting-edge scientist who really thinks very carefully about the application of science in benefiting people's lives, and has a fascinating career all the way through working with DARPA, work on AI and robotics, to where she is now. And Corrie, I thought it'd be good just to start if you could give us a little bit about your own background and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks so much, Derek, for having me. It's really fun to be able to talk to you and see you, although no one else will see us. My background, I have a bit of an eclectic background in terms of my degrees, because each time I was getting a degree, I actually wasn't thinking about what I wanted to be or what degree I wanted. I was finding cool labs to work in. And then I had to piece together degrees so that I could graduate. So my undergraduate degrees are in biopsychology and mathematics. And I ended up working in a lab looking at how could physical stimuli affect our perception. And I built a whole system so that you could put your arms, lock your arms down, and then you would vibrate your muscles and you would change what your visual field looked like. And I just thought it was really cool to put together this like crazy system that could fool your brain into seeing something that wasn't really there. What the passion that I think, in hindsight's 2020, my real passion was how does technology facilitate science? And that's the theme that then brought me forward into my graduate work, which was in aerospace engineering and neuroscience. And for my master's thesis, I showed how you could use an augmented reality or virtual reality system to retrain your motor system using your visual system. So the reverse from what I did as an undergraduate. In one of those experiments, I showed that if you moved your arm to the right, but the visual field moved to the left, you could actually retrain your brain so that now whenever you wanted to move an object to the left, you had to move your arm to the right. So those were very, very narrow scientific questions, but it was technology that was able to get us to the answer. But really, it was during getting my PhD in neuroscience that led me to the bigger picture. We were looking at how does spaceflight affect the human body and how humans can perform in space. And my PhD thesis was looking at how does the change in gravity affect how our visual and balance systems interact. I was able to test that using, big mechanical systems that we could change the acceleration that our brain was experiencing here on Earth, and then we could also look at what happened in space where it's zero gravity. So that looking at space flight and how technology could facilitate science, it also led me to this concept of dual use technologies. Or technology transfer. How can you use technology to enable humans to do something they couldn't do before? And then how can you use this technology for good elsewhere? And then just to sort of wrap up the background, I ended up working with the National Rehabilitation Hospital in DC when I finished graduate work. And we developed a multi-million dollar center funded both by the Department of Defense and the rehabilitation division of the Department of Education. And we were focused on this concept of dual use technologies, robotics, telemedicine, virtual reality, sensors, you know, and this is back in the mid 90s. So how could these technologies be used to drive forward science and human capability in medicine, in the Department of Defense, and other, you know, in any domain?
Yeah, and I think that brings us to one of the places we met and had lots of discussions at the World Economic Forum when you were chairing the work on human enhancement. And I think at the time, the vision of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, bringing together exactly the technologies that you had straddled, whether it was AI, the combination of biotechnology, and obviously driven by strong big data analytics, to ask the question, where are the areas of nearing human enhancement potential that have the greatest chance of having an impact? And I'd love your thoughts about just on the work of that committee and what were some of the high points of discussion, because you could have gone anywhere in terms of human enhancement.
Yeah, no, that was the Global Futures Council on Human Enhancement was fascinating because you're right, it could have gone in a lot of different directions. And I think where we ended up going, we ended up doing a survey, a nationwide survey, US-based, but it was a representative sample of the entire US on what people from ages 18 to 65, and this was in conjunction with AARP, they funded the study, and it was to look at what the perceptions of technology and the use of technology to enhance ability. And we defined enhancing ability along a spectrum. It was going from restoring ability. So if you lose your eyesight, you know, restoring your eyesight. And almost everyone, I think, you know, maybe a few exceptions, believe that that's an appropriate use of technology, ethical use, and should be used. Where it got a little fuzzy is the other end of the spectrum, which was to give eyesight to, for example, to enhance ability beyond the normal levels of human ability. So, for example, you know, using contact lenses that would give you telescopic vision or night vision. So enhancing capabilities beyond human capability. People got a little more uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, I think. Both cost, safety, some of those obvious things, but also just the ethics behind doing that. I will say what was interesting, if you look at what people think is ethical for society and what they want for themselves is a little different. If you ask, you get a very different answer if you ask them, do you want this technology for society and do you think it's equitable and do you want it for yourself? So people tend to recognize, yeah, I may want that capability, but it's not necessarily appropriate for society. And I'll tell you, of physical capabilities like bionic knees to sensing capabilities like vision or hearing, and then the third category was sort of cognitive abilities, thinking capabilities. Those were the ones that I think drove the biggest fear. People are really afraid of losing their cognitive abilities, their memory, their thinking ability. And I think because there's so much more information about Alzheimer's and some of these other things that happen as we age, that those actually had a little more acceptance and were the technologies that people desired the most, those that would preserve their cognitive abilities more than physical or sensory.
Yeah, and I think one of the things which I'm sure you weren't trying to look at was how will you use the technologies to help people see the future, but I think thinking about that, I think it seems almost paradoxical that the incredible advances in science and technology that could create these huge opportunities are also creating enormous fears and angst among groups of the population. And we're seeing either because it's in absolute terms happening or because the social media is amplifying it, the rise of fake news, the critique of science, the anti-science, anti-vax, a range of scientific things arising. And in some parts of the world, I mean, let's face it, in the US, we've seen a rollback of the highest level of scientific advice and support in policy making, with probably bad consequences. And I know this is something you've also thought about deeply and been part of groups who look at how do we actually make sure that we draw upon the best of science. What have been some of your reflections on some of these setbacks that we're seeing, and I say the rise of the anti-science movement, and what is it that we're actually going to be able to do to overcome it?
Yeah, I mean, the retreat from science during this administration has been beyond shocking, and to the point of negligence during the pandemic. And just to back up a little bit before I say more about that, you know, just as someone, you know, as I said, I mean, I just firmly believe that technology can facilitate science, and you know, my company, the name of my company is Anthrotronics, Human Instrumentation. My past 25 years, I've been dedicated to inventing the future through how we can use technology to hypothesis test and move technology, and particularly technology that enables ability, whether it's for people with disabilities or astronaut in space or training surgeons. So for me to see that we're going backwards in terms of that science and technology are disabling the population because the lack of scientifically based facts and just pure fear and partisanship. And, you know, I mean, I think, and it's also quite shocking because when the first March of Science was held back in 2017, what was so incredible to me is that it felt very bipartisan and family friendly. Like, it really felt like the majority of the population was saying, yes, science is important, facts are important, you know, hypothesis testing is exactly how our children need to be thinking and we need to be thinking. And it really felt unlike, I mean, I've been to many marches over the past 3 years, and I don't always bring my kids because I don't always feel like it's safe or appropriate. And you know, you just don't know what you're going to get. But the March for Science really felt like, wow, everyone gets it, and we're in the majority, and we're going to turn this around. So, especially now to see this kind of negligence rearing its ugly head during the pandemic, just feels it just is a gut punch.
Yeah, and I think one of the other areas, I know you've also been very focused in on, it's not just looking at what science has done, but who is involved in science, and how do we expand the inclusion and diversity of the brains and the people. I'm always reminded of a quote by Bill Clinton many years ago, when he said that brains are globally distributed, their use is not. And what he was really referring to was the need to draw upon minority groups, increasing use of women, the LGBTQ community, folk who usually don't have a chance at a table. And I know all of those things you believe very strongly. I'd love to get your sense of, as we draw in a wider group of people into the scientific endeavor, do you think we're more likely to be able to solve the problems that affect those communities and generally overall? And how will we actually see enormous benefits by expanding diversity and inclusion in the science process itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm actually very encouraged because I feel that the conversation has shifted from what we shouldn't do to what we should do. And, you know, I think a perfect example of that is the book that I believe you first introduced me to a couple years ago, Invisible Women, when it came out, which talks about how women need to be included in scientific studies or any study for that matter, any research, and the lack of, you know, half of the population being included in many of our not only, you know, medical standards, but also design standards, like for car airbags, things like that. So I'm encouraged that the shift in conversation is happening, that we're recognizing these isms for what they are: sexism, racism, heterosexism, and that we're and what we should be doing. And I think the conversation has turned to this: is acknowledging our own privilege, and become better allies and even better advocates for inclusion. And I think there's some great websites. Two of my favorite right now, talking about how to be an advocate or strong ally, is whiteaccomplices.org. Does a fantastic job of showing how you can do that in different domains. Of course, it's focused on racism, but I think it's applicable for being an ally in any environment where you are not, where you don't, where you have privilege. And then PFLAG is a great one for LGBTQ specific allyship. But absolutely, I agree that that's so critical for science, to make science as inclusive as any part of our society. And as I said, I'm very encouraged that the conversation has shifted from what we shouldn't do to what we should do.
Yeah, Kori, well, thank you enormously. And I think we're very proud to have you as a member of the board of the foundation to guide us to make sure that the science is of the highest quality. And as you know, just in the last few weeks, colleagues around the world have released very important reports showing how the neglect of Indigenous people has explained why they have 2 to 3 times the smoking rates of the general population. Engaging them in the solutions will turn up new solutions and will solve the problems for them. Similarly, we're seeing the same with regard to women, where we're seeing trends going in the wrong direction in many parts of the world, and yet we haven't had women as scientists and leaders in the field deciding what is actually going to be best from the biology, the cultural, and their perspective. And then finally, the world of mental health, where we have this data which is so clear that 70% plus of people with schizophrenia and many with depression smoke, yet their needs and their interests in the design of solutions that address both their mental health issues and their smoking status has still been neglected. And I think directing us to push hard on that will have universal benefits. And for that, thank you enormously. And let me just end off by saying to people, please contact us for more information at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. And of course, stay safe. Remember that the rules about wearing a mask, staying socially distanced, benefit you, your family, and everybody. It's going to be a long road, but together we can actually make it better. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek.